From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato.
Congress can't stop the Iran deal, and some House Republicans say they were tricked. President Obama says the U.S. will take 10,000 Syrian refugees. Is that enough? And Bernie Sanders tops the Iowa polls while Jeb Bush proposes a tax cut on himself. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, correspondent for The Upshot at The New York Times. On the left is Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at truthdig.com. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and our special guest this week is Katrina Vandenheuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
It's a done deal, as they say. Democrats used a filibuster to stop the Senate from voting to disapprove the Iran deal. While a law passed earlier this year allowed the president to save the deal with his veto, now he won't even have to, and it seems the House won't even vote on disapproving the deal after some Republicans decided the process had been rigged and they didn't want to vote. Katrina, so a lot of people have been talking about this deal and the Obama presidency as a turning point in the U.S.-Israel relationship. Historically, both political parties have had close and warm relationships with Israel and have seen mostly eye-to-eye on foreign policy. But in this instance, the Israeli government lobbied really hard against this deal and lost. What do you think happened?
Well, let me just step back for 1 minute and just say I think what we're looking at is potentially a seismic shift. This was a huge victory for tough, principled diplomacy over military action, which has so defined U.S. engagement with the world for these past decades. Listen, the American-Israel Political Action Committee, AIPAC, doesn't represent the majority of American Jewish opinion. And I think AIPAC went to war against this deal along with Prime Minister Netanyahu. They lost. They lost big. They've lost in previous instances in U.S. Israeli relations. But I think it's a win for opening up the dialogue to a full range of American Jewish voices. And I think it's important to remember that what Netanyahu and AIPAC did essentially made Israel the red state, another red Republican state, when in fact, again, there was a range of views inside Israel, former head of the Shin Bet, former head of Mossad, a full range of former security generals and other figures. So I think it's important to step back, remember that. And, you know, the war in Iraq did far more to empower Iran than this deal will. So all in all, I think it's a win-win. I think it's an important moment also on this anniversary of 9/11, which was so misused, took us into war with Iraq. Let us now think about supporting diplomacy over war. And remember that 91% of Senate Democrats voted for diplomacy over war, 86% of House Democrats. See change from those dark days in the fall of 2002 when too many Democrats went along with the Bush administration's war in Iraq.
Rich, I want to get your thoughts on that. And I also would wonder if you could speak to what's happened in Congress this week, particularly in the House, because I've honestly been confused. So what happened there?
Well, a couple things. The advantage of the Corker legislation, which reversed, of course, the usual standard for Congress approving a treaty. You usually need two-thirds of the Senate to approve a treaty. This reversed it. You need two-thirds of the Senate effectively to stop it. The upsides were supposedly that you would see everything having to do with this deal, and that was written in quite sweeping and explicit terms in the legislation, and you would actually get a vote to have people on record. And Republicans woke up this week and realized, you know what, we're actually getting neither of those things, because the side agreements haven't been provided to Congress, perhaps because they are so embarrassing. And two, the Democrats held pretty much on party lines with a few exceptions, and they filibustered the vote in the Senate. So the House said, look, we're not going to go along with the charade. We're going to pass a resolution saying that the administration did not fully comply with the terms of this statute as an effort to undermine its legitimacy. This is something that the public opposes by a 2-to-1 margin. There was a poll out this week that showed just about 21% of people support this deal. And hopefully we'll see you in January 2017 if there's a Republican president.
Bob, what do you make of that? Setting aside for a second the substance of this deal, are Republicans right about their process complaints here, basically, that Congress has been inappropriately shut out? And should the president have been more collaborative on this?
Well, I mean, who are the Republicans to complain? They took us to war in Iraq, which has got us all into this, without honestly consulting Congress or respecting any of the notion that Congress is supposed to declare war. They lied about the reasons. And I might say the whole controversy about Iran was started by the Republicans, for goodness sake. You know, there had been a time when Iraq was supported in its war with Iran. The people who elevated Iran to this critical position of power was George W. Bush and the people around him, because they decided that in response to the 9/11 attack, and when we're recording this, it's an anniversary now of, you know, long passage of event that had tremendous impact on America. We didn't go after the people who supplied 15 of the 19 hijackers. They were Saudi Arabia. They also gave us the leader. They supplied a lot of the funding, but those Sunnis were forgotten. You know, we made peace with Pakistan, which has 80 nuclear weapons. We decided we couldn't have a boycott against Pakistan or pressure them, because they now were the good people needed for this larger war, and ignored the fact that Pakistan has actually given a key technology to North Korea, to Libya, and to Iran. And so suddenly the whole thing was turned around to fight Al-Qaeda, a movement backed by Saudi Arabia. We went to war with Saddam Hussein in Iraq, who had nothing to do with it. Al-Qaeda could not operate in Iraq. And in result, we picked people who were living in exile in Iran. That's the government in Iraq. We put these people into power. They do represent a majority of the population, the Shiite majority. But the impact on the whole region, whether it's Libya now, and certainly Iraq, and Syria, was to elevate the importance of Iran and to diminish the importance of the pro-Sunni faction. The result is now we have ISIS as a response, and we have people in Iraq who are very close to the people in Iran. You can't make Iran a pariah state at a time when you need Iran to bring about peace in the Mideast. And that's the reality.
No, I was going to say, I mean, this deal was sold as a way of preventing Iraq from developing nukes. And I believe it will. I think Rich Lauer is talking about breakout time, this and that. This is rigorously negotiated. But I hope that if this deal is implemented effectively, it will not only prevent Iran from developing nukes, but it could also transform the Middle East.
Rich, I want to get your response here, but I just want to ask Katrina for one quick clarification. When you say this can reshape the Middle East, are you talking about more of an alliance essentially between the U.S. and Iran, given the shared interests between our two countries?
I don't see
around
I don't
ISIS.
See, well, I think that you need strong partnerships. I wouldn't say alliances in order to confront ISIS and in order to confront the major challenges of our time. I mean, we're going to talk about what's going on in Syria, which is at the root cause not only of the rise of Islam, but this horrific, cruel refugee crisis. So I do think that it's important to change the mindset to perpetual adversaries and to find ways to work together.
Rich, you were going to say something.
Yeah, so let me just address a few of the points going back to what Bob was saying. I think it's always important to remember that President Bush actually got congressional authorization for his wars, which is different than the way this president has operated. Bush got the authorization both in Afghanistan and Iraq. And on the Iraq war, yes, it was inevitable that an Iraq that was no longer governed by a Sunni dictatorship and actually had a politics more reflective of the makeup of the majority Shia country was going to be more friendly to Iran. I mean, that's just an unavoidable reality. But let's not fool ourselves. Iran has only overrun the country after President Obama fully pulled out and basically eliminated our influence and created a vacuum there. Now, on this deal, multiple polls have showed people are opposed 2-1 to this deal. And the bar the president had to get over to win this, you know, wonderful victory and historic victory in Congress was extremely low. He just needed to hold most of his party. And the fact is, AIPAC is not going to go out and primary anyone. The left just might. And the left supports this deal and was going to have more sway than AIPAC or anyone else. And then just in the last point, that this deal is going to create a shining new future in the Middle East. Where is it that Iranian proxy forces have ever brought more peace and order and stability anywhere in the Middle East. And now they'll have tens of billions of dollars more to pour into those activities,
you know,
around the region.
This is all absurd. I mean, the Republicans took us into a war in Iraq to destroy and prevent nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. They didn't exist. Didn't exist. At the same time, they ended a boycott on Pakistan that had developed the Muslim bomb and had been responsible. So they're not serious about preventing nuclear proliferation. And as Katrina correctly points out, this represents very significant progress in preventing an Iranian bomb if one is intended. And, you know, as opposed to Pakistan, which actually has these bombs, and Israel, by the way, which has these bombs, if one is concerned about Iran having one, certainly a 15-year delay, which is agreed upon by anyone of any expertise involved in here, is a major victory for Kerry and Obama. To deny that, and not mention, by the way, you haven't mentioned, what is the Republican alternative? To continue the sanctions? To continue putting Iran in a belligerent state? You know, where is your program?
I would have maintained the sanctions that, as of a year or two ago, most people thought had brought the Iranian economy to the verge of collapse. And the president just threw that away. And now we're told, well, look, the international sanctions regime has unraveled, so there's no choice but for the U.S. but to go along with this policy. But the president was the one who unraveled the international sanctions regime. And we started this process, you know, a negotiation over whether Iran would have a nuclear program and nuclear infrastructure or not. They built it up during the course of the negotiations, and they now get to keep most of it. It's a brilliant victory for Tehran.
Well, let us know what you think about the Iran deal at kcrw.com/LRC. Up ahead, the Syrian refugee crisis, plus Bernie's rise and Jeb's taxes. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of the New York Times. On the left is Robert Scheer, author of the new book, They Know Everything About You. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and Katrina Vandenheuvel of The Nation magazine is also with us. So as the migrant crisis in Europe continues, President Obama announced that the United States will increase its role by accepting 10,000 Syrian refugees, still a tiny number compared to the millions of Syrians who've been displaced by civil war, most of them having fled to neighboring countries, but many of them, as seen on TV in the last weeks, having fled to Europe. However, it is more than a five-fold increase from the rate at which we had been accepting them. Bob, what do you make of this? Is this enough? What's our obligation here?
Well, obviously it's not enough. We're the ones that caused this refugee flow. I know Rich will disagree with me strongly on that, but we destabilized regimes in Libya and Syria. We unleashed an extreme force in ISIS that was contained, just as it had been in Iraq, by Saddam Hussein. We decided we could do nation building, we being the U.S. government. I hardly supported it. But the fact of the matter is we created great chaos, as we did in Vietnam, as we did with Cuba, and earlier policies. In these earlier instances, we at least assumed the responsibility to care for refugees caused by our own folly. So we took in hundreds of thousands of people from Cuba and then hundreds of thousands from Vietnam as refugees. We at least recognized, not every time, but at least in those two instances, we recognized we had a human rights obligation. We had intruded into their domestic politics. And that's what's happened in Syria. You know, whatever you thought about the Saad family, whatever you thought about Gaddafi, these were basically dictators that were able to maintain some sense of order and hope. And we decided we had an alternative. The alternative has turned out to be Al-Qaeda. It's turned out to be ISIS. It's turned out to be maniacs believing in a very primitive view of religion. And the North normal population is frightened, understandably, and they take flight. And so since we created that mess in that region and are basically responsible for this flow of refugees, it shouldn't be up to Germany or Hungary, for that matter, to deal with the brunt of it. And it would seem to me, if we cared so much about the lives of these people, that we could invade them and do all of these things and separate their politics and try to determine their leadership, we should at least take care of the victims of our policy.
Rich, it seems to me like there's actually a related idea that I've been hearing on the right to what Bob said, which is, in a different way, a number of conservatives have contended basically that the Obama administration destabilized the Middle East and that the solution here was to ensure stability in Syria. Now, I don't think most of the people saying that from the right view the Assad regime as the desirable kind of stability in Syria. But is this a we broke it, we bought it kind of situation?
Well, I don't think we broke Syria. And I guess, Bob, I'm astonished to hear him say that Bashar al-Assad represented hope for his people.
Compared to ISIS, compared to al-Qaeda and the other elements that John McCain and other Republicans actually supported in a coalition that included those and ended up being led by those fierce elements.
If you actually look, as a matter of reality, what's happened on the ground, the Assad regime has, as a practical matter, forged a de facto alliance with ISIS to squeeze out the other forces based on the extremely cold-blooded but rational calculation that if our choices are just between ISIS and Assad, Assad would look much better. But the humanitarian price for that cynical calculation has been enormous. And to blame us, again, for what happened in Syria, when we've trained like 50 guys maybe to be on our side and be our rebels, is completely absurd. Now this is heart-rending, horrible tragedy. You feel very sorry for these people, but I don't think it's Europe's responsibility to take the bulk of them. I don't think it's our responsibility to take the bulk of them. I think it is our responsibility to try to lead a solution, to the extent we can find one, within the region, to support Turkey, to support Jordan, to support Lebanon, which have taken on millions of these people. So we may do 10,000, you know, you can double, triple, quadruple that, and it's still a drop in the bucket. And what Germany's doing, I think, is completely insane, because it's going to continue to draw this flow into Europe, where you have boats capsizing and people taken advantage of on this horrific trip. And other European countries will be affected, because Germany will be a magnet that draws these migrants into the other European countries in the hope that they ultimately make it to Germany. And just one last point. Yes, it's understandable that people want to get out of Syria. But once you're in Turkey, you're no longer in dire danger of your life. There's no reason you have to go from Turkey to Hungary. Once you're in Hungary, there's no reason you have to go Hungary to Germany. But if you tell most of the world, once you set a flight, you're going to end up in Germany, you're going to have an enormous flow.
Katrina, you had something.
Well, it's hard to come in here. I mean, obviously one begins with the necessity, the imperative of responding with compassion to the refugees. Whether it's more funding for the United Nations, which too often gets castigated when it is a valuable institution, for groups working on the ground. The Nation, thenation.com, has a call for the United States to take in at least 65,000 refugees. But I think we all know, and I think Bob noted this, I mean, that the rise of the Islamic State was sparked by the aftermath of the Iraq invasion, further fueled by the misguided tactics of the United States and Britain. Some people have called many of these refugees regime change refugees. It's a horrible characterization, but it speaks to overthrowing governments like Libya, where there are many refugees coming from, and that in doing so, there's a cavalier kind of disregard for what it will do and destabilize. And I think the idea of trying to bring some resolution to bear down, not with more weapons going to the region, to find a way to impose a moratorium on weapons, but to find some way to bring stability to these conflict-ridden countries that are going to supply millions more of these poor refugees coming to Europe. I agree with Rich that I think the countries in the region, the Gulf state countries, have a responsibility to deal with some of this. So I think that the Germany, I disagree with Rich. I think it's speaking to its best nature. But the other side of it is the blowback here. We are already seeing the European Union and Europe in crisis. Its response to Greece has been a failure. I think we're going to see more depression, more impoverishment of people, different kinds of refugees in that instance. The European Union's torn over a response to Russia. And I think we're going to see a very different U.S. transatlantic relationship, which will redefine the world. But at the root of it all, we need to address the refugees' humanitarian crisis, but we cannot forget the root cause of the crisis.
I want to talk a little bit more about that issue of refugee flows and integrating and accepting people, because after this announcement from the Obama administration, you had varying reactions from politicians in the U.S., some saying that 10,000 isn't enough, others saying it was too much. You had Peter King saying that this was going to lead to events like the Boston Marathon bombing. But I thought Marco Rubio actually said something measured and quite responsible about it, which is basically he's open to taking these refugees in, but we need to make sure that we're doing effective screening so that terrorists are not able to use the chaos of a humanitarian crisis to slip through. And I'm wondering what that process actually looks like. It seems like 10,000 is a fairly small number. It shouldn't be that hard to do it. But if we were to scale up to these larger numbers, does security become a valid concern in evaluating these flows? Bob, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's just what is he talking about? I mean, the terrorists, 9/11, this is the anniversary as we record this, the 15 from Saudi Arabia had valid papers. They were given and granted initially by a government we continue to support. We support Saudi Arabia. We support the government of Egypt, by the way, even though it's destroyed any vestige of democracy and continues to jail their first democratically elected leader. We don't care about human rights at all in this situation, and we really don't care about stopping terrorism. Saudi Arabia has been the major funder of terrorism in the world, and we embrace them to this day, and we invade countries that they want us to invade, you know. We make a whole big thing about the border with Mexico. There's not one example of a terrorist coming through the border of Mexico. Where is the Mexican terrorist? So border security has nothing to do with it. We certainly have the ability to process refugees. And I think what you have here is a very weird thing. We were willing to go to war in the Mideast because we claim we care about human rights. But then it turns out we don't care about human rights if they happen to be Muslim, you know? And we admitted hundreds of thousands of people from Vietnam, from Cuba, from other countries that are in battle to suggest that people are leaving Syria. Now, many of these people are well-educated, were productive members of the society, as they were in Iraq, as they were in Libya. They are leaving because they are frightened. Their children's lives are threatened. There is no sustainable life. And we are the major agency for having disrupted life in that part of the world.
We invaded Iraq how long ago now? You know, a decade,
well, I mean,
more?
I think we're
seeing
the unraveling of the
And then all of a sudden that a decade later that destabilized Syria, which we didn't touch, and we had a president who explicitly went out of his way not to touch, and somehow the collapse of Syria into this horrific violence and civil war is our fault, I find completely mind-boggling.
I think this is a bipartisan indictment, because Bush and the war in Iraq, a horrific failure for any security. But it is the case, and it's wrong. President Obama has sent weapons to, quote, moderate Syrian rebels. Libya, with all the talk about Hillary's emails, the greatest danger to national security under Hillary Clinton was the way she presided over Libya. And I think the debacle there and in Syria and, of course, the original sin in Iraq have contributed to the unraveling, by the way, of something we haven't talked about. Whatever happened to the Arab Spring? I mean, we are seeing the gutting, the unraveling, the brutality of the unraveling of the Arab Spring, and millions of people, these millions of refugees flowing across this region.
But I think the screening issue that
Josh raised effectively, I think the major problem, Josh, is that if that's one end of it, but if the response to this is more military intervention in this region, more bombing, more weapons coming in, you're going to be creating more terrorists, just as you're saying you're screening potential ones. I think that creates more terrorists, and these people are essentially fleeing from conflict. If they go back into that conflict, they're more likely to be turned in some way.
Rich, I'll let you get the last word here.
Yeah, sure. The Arab Spring was an indigenous process. We didn't create the Arab Spring. And in Libya, you can argue counterfactuals in various ways. But if you look at the example of Syria, the horrible dictator was left in place, and the country still collapsed into terrible chaos. So it may be that Libya would be just as chaotic today, just with Gaddafi still in power, barrel bombing people and all the rest of it. So
the
last thing I would point out is that we are a country that is extremely open to migrants already. I mean, the size of our foreign-born population is larger than most countries. So if we're going to really get an enormous quantity here, let's subtract from some of that. But in immigration policy, no one ever talks about reducing. It's always more, more, more. And part of the populist revolt that's going on in both parties, and both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump reflect this, is actually the public thinking, well, maybe we should have a little less.
Unfortunately, I have to cut it off there. We have reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Bob Scheer, it's your soapbox.
Yeah, I want to shout out in praise of the Pope, who has reminded us that every human being has a soul, whether they're Muslim, whether they're Jewish, whether they're Christian. And I think his principal call in Europe, which unfortunately the Catholic Church didn't have at the time of World War II, but the principal call demanding the openness to refugees and concern for refugees sets a great example for the world that the United States should also follow.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, what's on your mind?
Okay, so Mayor de Blasio of New York City has taken a beating this past summer, but he has fulfilled one of his important campaign promises. And I ask, why is de Blasio's extraordinary achievement of putting 65,000 four-year-olds into free full-day preschool, the largest expansion of public school of its kind in this country, not given sufficient credit? I think that is extraordinary. I would say one last thing, because we didn't talk about Bernie Sanders, but why is Bernie Sanders' surge, as he amplifies issues which resonate with millions and demand attention, viewed in the mainstream media largely through what it means for Clinton and Biden and not on its own terms?
Rich Lowry, what's your rant?
True to his boorish form, Donald Trump mocked Carly Fiorina's appearance, saying no one with her face could possibly get elected president. And then when he was called on it, said that no, actually, he was just talking about her persona. Donald Trump insults a lot of things, but please, Mr. Trump, don't insult our intelligence.
For my rant, Jeb Bush released his tax plan this Wednesday, and it got a lot of attention for the fact that it would end the carried interest loophole and eliminate various deductions for high earners. But when you go through the math and really look through the plan, it is another really large tax cut focused mostly on earners at the top of the distribution. People who make more than $10 million a year currently pay about 26% of their income in federal income tax on average. The Jeb Bush plan would take it down to 21%. This is really very much another version of the same old Republican plans on taxes, except unlike Mitt Romney, who said he would expand the tax base enough to keep the deficit the same, Bush is openly admitting that this plan would significantly increase the deficit. I'm waiting to see if Donald Trump, who's been saying he's going to put out an actual tax plan, will do something that is unusual for the Republican Party. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Robert Scheer, Rich Lowry, and Katrina VandenHeuvel. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Sarah Singer Schiff is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes, and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.